Just follow the discussion, and basically, if you have questions, interrupt me at any time and ask me to clarify certain points. I don't have any prepared material. I usually find it much more interesting to talk off the top of my head and go through the material that I have to present. So basically, I'm supposed to talk about antimatter, and before talking about antimatter, or saying what we do here at CERN with antimatter, I have to give a short introduction as to what antimatter is and why it's such an interesting topic. Now, antimatter you know about. It's very common in science fiction. You've heard the term, but it actually dates rather far back in history. The first antimatter was predicted about, well, not quite 100 years ago, 80 years ago. And it was basically predicted based on two equations. The first one you know, everybody knows, but people don't usually think about what it actually means in detail. Because it basically just says that you can transform energy into matter, into mass, or vice versa, mass into energy. So that's the first one. And the other one is the Dirac equation, which Dirac set up to try to explain the behavior of electrons at very high energies. And when he went through his equations, trying to find a solution to his equation, he found that there are actually two solutions. There's one solution which describes the behavior of electrons, and there's a second solution which describes the behavior of something that looks like electrons but has the wrong charge, has a positive charge. And based on that, he predicted that there would be something like an electron having the properties of an electron but with the wrong charge. And it was only in, this was in 1928, and it was only shortly afterwards, 1932, I think, that the first anti-electron was actually discovered. The first positron was discovered in cosmic rays coming from the sky. And this is one of the few occasions where theorists actually predict something that is found afterwards, rather than post-dicting something that has already been discovered. So 1932, first positron found. And at that point, people realized that you could have particles that were just like normal particles, the ones that we know, but have the opposite charge, the opposite properties. And so people realized at that point also that you could consider, you could think about making similar analogs for every particle that was known. At this time, there were not very many particles that were known. It was just basically proton, electron, neutron, not much more than that. And so you could think, in that case, of making an antiproton, an anti-electron, and an anti-neutron. Now, of course, positrons are relatively easy to find. You find them in cosmic rays, and in the meantime, people have found that they also are produced naturally in radioactive decays, and I'll say more about that later. But for these heavier particles, like an antiproton or an antineutron, you actually need to make them. You cannot just find them in nature, and the way you make them is with an accelerator. So you need to do, well, you have to have some kind of energy that transforms itself into mass again, and it has to transform itself into pairs, proton antiproton pairs plus something, because you need to conserve energy and momentum, and especially you need to conserve charge. And so to get this energy, you do what particle physicists are very good at doing. You build an accelerator and you shoot protons onto some heavy block of material. You accelerate the protons onto the block of material, and you transform the kinetic energy into potential energy, the potential energy then into pairs of matter and antimatter. So this is all very fine and good, and it's fun to do, but what's the real point? Now, well, the real point is, if you go back to this equation, or this process here, you think about every time you transform energy, you condense energy, you make matter, but you also make antimatter at the same time in the same amount, because you have to conserve charge, energy, and momentum. And there's one process where energy was transformed into matter, which is quite dramatic. It's what happened 15 billion years ago. If you look at the universe, it's expanding. It's going flying apart. If you run the movie backwards, 15 billion years ago, the universe was at a very dense state where there was a very high density of energy. And this energy, when it condensed into matter, must have made the same amount of antimatter. Everything we know says there must have been as much antimatter in the universe as matter. The only problem is that there is no antimatter in the universe at all left right now. And the way we know that is, well, here on Earth, if there were antimatter, it would run the inverse process. Proton, antiproton, or matter, antimatter would transform itself into energy, and you'd have huge explosions. So there's no antimatter on Earth because it would immediately annihilate with matter. We know that there's no antimatter in the solar system, or at least not on the moon. The moon is made of matter, otherwise the astronauts would not have come back. We know there's no Mars is not made of antimatter, and neither is Venus, because we've landed probes on those two planets. And you can also check that there is no antimatter on any of the asteroids and so on, because they continuously fall down on Earth. So in the solar system, there's no antimatter. The sun is not made of antimatter because it continuously emits solar wind. And the solar wind is protons. No antiprotons there. And you can ask yourself, how far out can you go and exclude the presence of matter or of antimatter? Well, certainly within our galaxy, you can exclude it, because there are particles coming from the galaxy called cosmic rays, and you can test their nature. You can measure whether they're protons or antiprotons by a very simple experiment. And that's another place where CERN has these beautiful telescopes. They're called particle detectors, and they're underground. So normally you don't think of them in terms of telescopes. But in fact, if there are particles coming from space, they can traverse the atmosphere, they can traverse the ground, and go in through the detector and be detected inside a detector. So let me draw a very rough sketch of what we have. Underground here, we have a small detector, for example, Aleph. The Aleph detector at LEP, or any of the LEP detectors. And if cosmic rays come through, they will produce a track. And because it's a magnet, it's a very strong magnet, these detectors contain very strong magnetic fields, you will get a small curvature inside this magnetic field, and you can measure the charge of the particle. So you can see whether it's a proton or an antiproton. Now, that's not very efficient, because if the particles are very rapid, the magnetic field is not very strong, curvature is very small, you cannot distinguish between proton and antiproton. But you can use a trick. You can use another magnetic field, not one that you make yourself, but one that is naturally available, the magnetic field of the Earth. If these particles are charged in one direction, the magnetic field of the Earth will bend them like this. And if they're charged in the other, if they're opposite charge, they'll be bent in the other direction. So coming from here. Now, that doesn't help you very much, because particles are coming from all over. So you don't know whether a particle that comes here is actually coming from here or from here. But then you use another trick. Physicists are very prosaic. They don't consider the moon a very beautiful, poetic object. They consider it a beam blocker. So if I put a moon here, it's going to block all the particles that come here. They will be stopped. And so I will see, if I look in the direction of the moon, the shadow of the moon. I can reconstruct the direction from where all the particles come in these detectors, and the ones that come from the direction of the moon are blocked off. And depending on the charge of the particles, the shadow of the moon, because of the Earth's magnetic field, will be shifted in one direction or in the other direction. And in fact, if you look at the shadow of the moon inside these detectors, you see that all the particles come only from positively charged particles, from protons, no antiprotons. So we know that the cosmic rays are exclusively made of protons. Now, that's a very indirect way of doing it. You can also send a satellite up here with a magnet and measure the same thing, and that was done on the space station Freedom by an experiment called AMS. We're looking for antiprotons in the cosmic rays, and they have found a very, very small number, which are basically produced by this process here. So there are no antiprotons, there's no antimatter in our galaxy. And you can go even further, you can look at galaxies inside with a telescope, with a real telescope this time, when two galaxies collide. This happens occasionally, in the universe is a big place, and occasionally galaxies do collide. And if one were made of matter and the other one were made of antimatter, the two galaxies, as they collide, will have a very clean signature of annihilation radiation at the point where they interact. And this annihilation signature is mostly due to electrons and positrons transforming themselves into two photons. This is the process where a positron annihilates with an electron and produces two photons of light, which contain exactly the energy equivalent to the mass of the electron. So these are 511 keV photons. And you can look at the universe in that frequency range, and it's just that color. You look at the universe, whether you see that light shining anywhere, and you see that the whole universe is black. Almost the whole universe is black. The only place where you can see this light is from the center of our galaxy. there's a fountain of positrons which are being created continuously at the center of our galaxy, and this is basically due to supernovas or black holes radiating, transforming, well, accelerating particles which collide with other particles and then produce pairs of electrons and positrons, and these positrons can then annihilate again later on with electrons. So basically the universe is empty of antimatter, which is a problem. I mean, all the matter you see in the universe, this 10 to the 80 particles that are in the universe, they're all matter particles. And there must have been a similar number, or a larger number, 10 to the 80 or more antiparticles, and they're all gone. So where have they gone, and how could they disappear? They're not in this universe anymore, as far out as we can see. So the only thing that you can think of is that there is something different between matter and antimatter. There's a slight asymmetry, something that distinguishes matter from antimatter. The problem is that 20th century physics is founded on a series of assumptions, of theories, that predict that matter and antimatter have absolutely the same properties, that there's no difference whatsoever. And if you look at what properties you can think about in, when you talk about a particle and antiparticle, it's basically its mass, its charge, its magnetic moment, and its lifetime. So you have these four properties: mass, charge, magnetic moment, and lifetime. That should be identical for particles and antiparticles, according to theory, according to everything we know about particles, but which should be different according to what we see in the universe. The universe is asymmetric, and so what physicists do in this situation is try to see if there's a slight difference somewhere in any of these parameters between matter and antimatter. And the easiest system to think about, or to work on, at least here at CERN, are antiprotons. So you compare protons and antiprotons, and you see if there's a difference. And one of the things you can do with a charged particle is lock it into a magnetic field. You just put a charged particle into a magnetic field. In this magnetic field, the particle will rotate, cyclotron movement, and the frequency of the cyclotron movement is proportional to the magnetic field times the ratio of the charge to the mass. So if I measure this frequency for a proton and for an antiproton in the same magnetic field, I can get a measurement of the charge to mass ratio and see if they're different for protons and antiprotons. So people have done that with protons, with antiprotons, put them in the same magnetic field, measured the frequency very precisely. It's like a radio emitter in a way, and if you build a very fine receiver for the radio, you can have a very clean signal. But the precision with which you can measure this is limited, and you can only reach a precision on this of less than 10 to the minus 10. So the difference between matter and antimatter, as measured with protons and antiprotons, is less than 1 part in 10 to the 10. Now that's limited because I said you have to do the measurement in the same magnetic field. But in real life, if you make a magnetic field and you put a particle into it, antiproton here, and it will rotate like that, and the proton here, and it will rotate like that. The problem is that you're not going to be able to put them at precisely the same spatial point. It's just limited. You can do it within a millimeter or so. But much more importantly, you can't do it at the same time. The magnetic fields that you generate in a coil are very precise, and you can control that very well. But the magnetic field generated by the Earth is variable. The magnetic field of the Earth is not something that is constant. It continuously changes. And at a level of 10 to the minus 10, it's fluctuating all over the place. It's wildly fluctuating. And you can try to interpolate and measure it and so on, but you're never going to be able to get it more precisely than that. So if you want to do a comparison of matter and antimatter to better than 1 part in 10 to the 10, you have to do something different. You have to work with neutral antimatter. Neutral antimatter, I mentioned before, there are neutrons and antineutrons. So that's one possibility. You could think of doing an experiment with antineutrons, if you can make them. And at CERN, we make them in the same numbers as we make antiprotons. But the problem then is, when you make them, they're flying off in some direction. And because they're neutral, well, you cannot hold on to them. You cannot control them. You have no handle on them. They just fly off and annihilate somewhere. So antineutrons can be studied, but it's a very difficult system to work with. And especially, you cannot work in a, you cannot trap them and hold on to them. Like you can neutrons. Neutrons can be trapped. If you make, you can make cold enough neutrons that you can catch them in a magnetic bottle and then work with them. You need to make very, very cold antineutrons, and the production, the probability of making a very cold antineutron is just extremely slow, low. So we will never be able to study antineutrons. But you can think of working with other systems. You can think of working with systems that are not elementary, but are composed. For example, a quark anti-quark system. This is neutral, and there's a system called the K0 bar, or the B0 or the B0 bar. One of them contains a strange quark, one of them contains a bottom quark. And these systems are being studied very actively here at CERN on experiments that, that have finished taking data or that are still running now, and also in San Francisco and in Japan. There are two experiments studying these particles here, and one of the LHC experiments is going to concentrate on studying these here, also to see if there's a difference between matter and antimatter. But the really interesting system that we'd like to study is this one here, hydrogen. A hydrogen atom is just a proton with an electron, and its antimatter equivalent is an antiproton with an antielectron. And the reason why you want to study this system is because it is a very sensitive system. It's one of the systems which allows the highest precision that you can think of. The reason for that is hydrogen, like any other atom, has energy levels. And if you measure the energy difference between two levels, you've measured something about the properties of, well, basically, it's some combination of masses and charges of protons and electrons. So this is the ground state, this is the first excited state, and so on. And if you are able to measure this difference here, the energy difference between the ground state and the first excited state, you are very lucky, because this state here, the 2s state, the first excited state, has a very, very long lifetime, almost 1 second. And so the energy difference is extremely well defined. It's defined to better than 1 part in 10 to the 16. So if you can measure that energy difference in hydrogen and in antihydrogen, you've compared matter and antimatter to 1 part in 10 to the 16, and that's a single measurement. If you repeat this measurement a few hundred thousand times, you get a square root of n improvement in the precision. So you can reach, in principle, 10 to the minus 18 or so. And this is a magic number. 10 to the minus 18 is a magic number in physicists' minds, because the difference between matter and antimatter has already been tested to that precision in this system here. In the K0, K0 bar system, which is a very specific system, one has measured the difference in mass between the K0 and the anti-K0, and is less than 1 part in 10 to the 18. So any other experiments that are proposed to measure differences between matter and antimatter have to compete with that measurement. So antihydrogen can compete. And the other reason why this is a magic number is that this is the area where theorists consider that it might be possible that the symmetry between matter and antimatter be broken. If you come up with some very exotic theories, extensions of the standard model, you can predict a breaking of the symmetry between matter and antimatter at 1 part in 10 to the 18 or below. Theorists always keep a back door open. The or below simply means that if we say that there is no difference at 10 to the minus 18, they will say, well, yes, but it can be 10 to the minus 19 or 10 to the minus 20. So this is the level we would like to try to reach with antihydrogen and hydrogen. And to do that, there are a number of steps that have to be, of technical steps that need to be made before you can do this kind of measurement. Well, the first technical step that you have to do is make antihydrogen, okay? If you've made antihydrogen, you have to trap antihydrogen so that you can study it. And if you've trapped it, you have to shine laser light onto it. You have to measure this energy difference by exciting the hydrogen or the antihydrogen with a laser so that you can get it to re-emit the light. So those are the three steps. And let me start from the end, because it's interesting to consider. So first, you have to make antihydrogen. Second, you have to trap antihydrogen. And third, you have to have a laser, 1s to 2s, so that you can excite the states. OK, well, let me start with the laser. This is a laser of 121 nanometers that's in the far ultraviolet, and there is no such thing. There is no such laser. It doesn't exist. People are working on it very hard, trying to make a laser like this, but up to now, without success. So we cannot do the experiment. We're going to hope that somebody else in another field, in the field of laser spectroscopy, is going to be smart enough to have solved the problem of building this laser by the time we can use it. Because we cannot do the experiment right now, because also this part here is impossible. At least we have no idea how to do it. We don't know how to trap antihydrogen. To trap a neutral particle, a neutral system, you can trap it via the magnetic moment. So if you have a system like this, it's actually an antiproton plus a positron, and the two particles have spins. And these spins can be aligned, they can be parallel or antiparallel. And you probably recall that an atomic system in a magnetic field has a Zeeman splitting of atomic levels. Do you remember? Okay. Well, the Zeeman splitting, if I draw it like this, this is the energy as a function of the magnetic field. It's basically two lines which increase in energy as the magnetic field goes up, and two lines which decrease in energy as the magnetic field goes up. So what this means is basically if you have an atom that is in one configuration, it can lower its energy by going to a lower field if it's in one configuration, or it can lower its energy by going to a higher field if it's in the other configuration. That's how you can catch, how you can trap any atoms, how people catch hydrogen, cesium, and so on. The problem with this is that the energy difference that we're talking about is something like, if you look at it, if you transform it into temperature, something like half a degree Kelvin. So this means that to catch an atom, it has to be extremely cold. It has to be at most half a degree Kelvin in temperature, above absolute zero. And so to trap antihydrogen, you have to make atoms that are very cold. Well, the first problem is we don't know how to make atoms that are very cold, and we don't know how to cool them down, because the way people cool down atoms right now is by bouncing them off cold walls. Now, that's a little bit difficult with antimatter. They're not going to come back. So we have to make them cold before we can actually trap them. That's the first problem. And the second problem is maybe even more severe, because if you make lots of antihydrogen atoms in whatever temperature distribution, some of them will be cold. It's always a Boltzmann distribution, so you're going to have a small fraction of the population that is sufficiently cold. But the real problem is that you have to make the antihydrogen in an environment in which you can catch it. And this environment is a very inhomogeneous magnetic field, because the magnetic fields like this, they have to be increasing in every direction. Charged particles do not have stable orbits in such a configuration. And so the question that we have to solve before we can even think about trapping antihydrogen is whether the particles that we use to make antihydrogen, the antiprotons and the positrons, can survive sufficiently long in such an environment so that we can make the antihydrogen atoms that we would then want to trap, and so on. So we're going to do experiments on trying to see whether these particles are stable in there. So let me at least come to the one part that we do know how to do, and that is to make antihydrogen. Although 2 years ago we didn't know how to do this, it was very new. We had many ideas how to make it, and the ideas are very simple, actually. It's you take an antiproton, you take a positron, and you shake them together and hope something good comes out. And that's exactly what nature does. It works like that. We take antiprotons, we take positrons, we put them together in the same area, and by magic, they make antihydrogen atoms. It turns out that it's much, much, much easier than we had thought to make antihydrogen. Although there are many technical difficulties that you need to solve before you can get there. So let me just say a few words about the two experiments that make antihydrogen atoms, that have made many atoms in the last 2 years. They're called Athena and ATRAP. And both of these experiments have the long-term goal of doing this, of doing laser spectroscopy of antihydrogen atoms. Both of these experiments started from the same point and are trying to work off one problem after the next, trying to get to the point where you can actually do something useful with antihydrogen. And both of these experiments get antiprotons from CERN, from the AD, the antiproton decelerator, and positrons from the radioactive decay of sodium-22. Sodium-22 is an isotope of sodium, and it decays radioactively into neon-22, plus a positron, plus a neutrino. And so to get the positrons that you need to make antihydrogen, all you have to do is catch these guys here. The source is relatively strong in both cases, and we produce some millions of positrons a second, which then have to be slowed down, captured, and I'll show you when we get there to the experiments how we actually do that. The antiprotons are produced, like I said before, by shooting protons onto something heavy, typically tungsten or lead or copper, and then produces pairs of protons, antiprotons, plus a whole lot of other stuff. Now, that's not really the whole story. This looks nice on paper, but in reality, this is not a very common occurrence. When you shoot a proton onto a target, most of the time, you don't get antiprotons coming out. You get pions, you get electrons, you get positrons, you get neutrons, you get protons, and only once in a million collisions do you get an antiproton. So the antiprotons are buried in this pile of junk that you want to get rid of, and they're coming out at energies that are very high, almost the speed of light, and very different directions. There are big variations in energy. And to use these antiprotons, CERN, or the accelerator, has to do a double job. It has to filter out all the junk, throw away all the particles that we're not interested in, and slow down the antiprotons until we can actually catch them. We can catch them once the antiprotons have been decreased from several hundreds of billions of electron volts down to about 5,000 electron volts. And so the accelerator spends a lot of its time, I'll explain how it does that, to slow down the antiprotons from practically the speed of light down to 100 million electron volts, from which we then take over and slow them down from 100 million electron volts down to 5,000 volts. The way the accelerator does this is by using the fact that antiprotons in particular, cannot annihilate with electrons. They can annihilate with protons, they can annihilate with neutrons, but they cannot annihilate with electrons. So if you shoot a beam of antiprotons, a cloud of antiprotons, through a cloud of electrons, the antiprotons will interact with the electrons, and in every collision, they're going to lose a little bit of energy. If you do this many, many times, the antiprotons will be slowed down, cooled down. The electrons, of course, will heat up and scatter and be thrown out, but the antiprotons will lose energy. And this process takes about 2 minutes. So every 2 minutes, we get a burst of 10 to the 7 antiprotons from the production target. These antiprotons circulate in the antiproton decelerator, interact with electrons over and over and over, are cooled until they come down to 100 million electron volts, and are then extracted into the experiment. And then we use a very high-tech device to slow them down from 100 million electron volts to 5,000 volts. And this high-tech device has about this shape. It's a rectangular sheet. It's aluminum. And it's basically what you use to wrap chewing gum in. It's a very thin sheet of aluminum. Antiprotons enter this stuff at 100 million electron volts. With a momentum of 100 million electron volts over C. Scatter with the atoms of this aluminum and lose energy, just like they were losing energy before with the electrons. And they come out here with an energy distribution which starts at zero and goes up to several hundred thousand, 500,000 kilo electron volts. And we can catch, I'll explain how, all the antiprotons that have an energy less than 5,000 volts. That corresponds to about 1 per mil of the antiprotons that we get in. So 99.9% of the antiprotons that come into our apparatus and that are slowed down by the foil still have too high an energy for us to catch. So they just go through our apparatus, annihilate, and get lost. And we can catch this 1 per mil. So out of the 10 to the 7 antiprotons that we get from the AD, we catch 10 to the 4 antiprotons trapped. And the way we do that is by shooting them into a magnet. The magnet is a very strong magnet, so that particles that want to go out in a radial direction will run on a spiral. They cannot escape radially because charged particles in the magnetic field run on a helix. And along the longitudinal direction, we apply electric fields. So out here is another surface that is set at 5,000 volts. And so if I draw the potential on axis, it looks like this, with this being at 5,000 volts. So antiprotons that come in will see this potential hill, will run up the hill. Those with an energy less than 5,000 volts will come back. Those with an energy higher than 5,000 volts will go over the hill and disappear downstream. And in the time it takes the slow antiprotons to go up and down, we've applied the same voltage to the entrance electrode. We have 200 nanoseconds between the moment the antiprotons come in and the moment they come back. But 200 nanoseconds is just enough to apply 5,000 volts. And then we have trapped, 10,000 antiprotons in this electromagnetic trap. Electric trap along the axis and magnetic transverse to the axis. And the two experiments do exactly the same thing. Up to here, it's the same. And then all you have to do is take the antiprotons that you've trapped on one side, the positrons that you've trapped on the other side, and move them together. And the only problem, and this is what distinguishes the two experiments, is what you do then. Once you've made the antihydrogen, once you've mixed these two particles, the particle types, is how you prove that you've made antihydrogen. And the way we prove that we made antihydrogen is by having a small detector outside the region where antihydrogen is made, which allows us to reconstruct both the antiproton nucleus annihilation, which produces pions, and the positron electron annihilation, which produces two photons of 511 keV. That happens here, and we can see the annihilation product. So when we make antihydrogen, we immediately destroy it, actually. We cannot hang on to it because we don't know how to trap it, but the first step was just to make it. And by combining these two signals, we can prove that we make antihydrogen rather than just seeing antiprotons annihilate alone or positrons annihilate alone. Just seeing an annihilation is not enough to prove that you've made a bound system. Okay, so this is where the experiment stands, and the numbers, just to give you an idea, is we make of the order of 1,000 antihydrogen atoms a second when we start mixing the two particles. So it's a pretty high rate. We were expecting one a second. We were expecting a very low rate, and it turns out that the calculations that we were relying on are rather wrong because they did not consider what happens when you have dense clouds of particles. The calculations assume that you have individual particles and they just try to see how likely it is that they hit each other. When in fact, when you have a very dense system, the positrons behave almost like a liquid, and the antiprotons diffuse inside this liquid like a cell in water. It's Brownian motion. And so the probability for finding a positron is much, much larger in a dense cloud of positrons than just an individual positron. So we know how to make large numbers of antihydrogen atoms. And now the next step is, of course, what is the temperature of antihydrogen? Are the antihydrogen atoms hot or are they cold? If they're cold, we're lucky and we can hope to catch them. If they're hot, well, that's probably the end of the road. We don't know how to slow them down. At least not from high energies, from hundreds of degrees or thousands of degrees. So this is the first critical question. The second critical question is, can you make antihydrogen in an environment where you can also trap it? So production of antihydrogen in an inhomogeneous magnetic field. So those are the two questions that we have to solve before we can think about trapping antihydrogen and before we can think about doing a precision experiment. So to give you an idea, to make antihydrogen is an endeavor that took us of the order of 5 to 6 years from the moment we had the idea to how to make it to the moment that we actually had a successful outcome of the experiment. So the next step of the experiment will also probably take some 5 to 6 years until we can trap antihydrogen, and then it will probably take another decade, I guess, until we can do high-precision spectroscopy of antihydrogen. So it's a very long-range plan, or very long-range endeavor. Now, if that were the only thing for antimatter, it would be very interesting academically and for physics reasons, but for society as a whole, it's perhaps not quite as important to know why the universe doesn't contain any antimatter. Society is more interested in technical applications, and there are a few technical applications of antimatter that might actually convince society to continue funding this. One of them, I should use a new paper for that, one of them you probably are familiar with. It's positron emission tomography, PET, as in PET scans, where you inject basically into... Stop me if you know this stuff already, and I can just skip it. Okay, it's important, just for one second, I will explain just a small detail. You basically inject a radioactive salt, sodium-22 or something similar, which will produce positrons, which migrate to cells with a high metabolism, say inside the brain, and there the positrons annihilate with electrons and produce two photons, which come out. And you can detect these with crystals, with a matrix of crystals, where the photons produce a small bit of light, and this can be detected. And if you look at different moments in time, different detectors will see something, and you can intersect all these straight lines and reconstruct by deconvolution the source where the positrons annihilate. So you can detect cancers at a very early stage because those are cells with a very high metabolism. You can also study behavior of the brain because brain cells that are involved in thinking or in mental activities are typically more active than the ones that are not involved in a mental activity. So you can study questions as interesting as, for example, when a child learns the second language as a child or as an adult, is it the same part of the brain that's involved or not? It turns out that no, as an adult, it's a different part of the brain that is used to learn the second language, whereas as a child, it's the same part of the brain as for the first language. And that explains in part why it's so difficult to learn a second language as an adult, because you're not using the part of the brain that's built for that. You're abusing other parts of the brain that are not made to learn languages. So that's one thing that antimatter is used for, and in fact, this allows you to see what's going on inside the brain, but the precision with which you can measure things is not very good. There's a method that allows you to map very precisely what is going on, the structure of the brain, and that's MRI, magnetic resonant imaging, which requires a very strong magnetic field. Positron emission tomography requires no magnetic field at all, because the light that is produced here is very weak, and the amplifiers that people used up to now they're very bulky, they're very big, and they don't work in magnetic fields. Now, very recently, technology has been developed for LHC that allows to transform these amplifiers from bulky electromagnetic devices into solid-state devices. They're silicon chips now. And these silicon chips are not sensitive to magnetic fields anymore. We, in our experiment, had to detect the photons coming from positron electron annihilation in crystals in an environment that is basically positron emission tomography, but in a very strong magnetic field, because we need the magnetic field to hold our particles. So we had to solve the problem of combining these two technologies, PET with MRI. And by using these chips that were developed for an LHC experiment, we were able to do positron emission tomography in a very strong magnetic field. Now, there's nothing to stop doctors, medical researchers, from doing exactly the same thing, using the technology we developed to now look whether you can actually do PET scans of animals or human beings at the same time as they do magnetic resonant imaging. So this is a technology that should be available within, 5 years, 10 years, something like that. And it was not the goal to solve a medical problem, of course. The goal for us was to solve the detection of antihydrogen. So this is a technology that's already well developed, but let me talk a bit more about a technology that's not well developed at all and that people are working on right now. And that is a technology that is to improve on what people are doing right now when they try to treat a cancer with radiation therapy. When you have a cancer, let's say here, you can irradiate it with particles. You can either irradiate it with X-rays, that's what people have been, gamma rays, high energy photons, That has a long tradition. More recently, people have been irradiating cancers with protons. And the reason why you'd switch from gamma rays to protons is the following. If I look at the energy that is deposited between the skin, the surface of the tissue, and the point that you want to reach, in the case of gamma rays, it looks like this. In the case of protons, so a lot of energy is deposited in the healthy tissue, between here and the cancer. A bit of energy is deposited in the region of the cancer, and a lot of radiation is deposited in the healthy tissue behind the cancer. It's not what you want. You don't want to irradiate the healthy tissue. You only want to damage the cancer. So when you work with gamma rays, you typically irradiate from different directions so that you dilute the dose of the healthy tissue and maximize the dose on the cancer. But it still damages the healthy tissue. In the case of the proton, very little energy is deposited here, and most of the energy is deposited here at the end of the range. Protons lose a little bit of energy as they go in, and as they slow down, they lose more and more and more energy, and then they stop. And that's the end of the story for protons. So you can focus more on the cancer itself, but you're still depositing energy in the healthy tissue here. Nothing back here, but in the entrance part, you are still depositing energy. And so some people had the idea of replacing protons with antiprotons. Now, what do you expect in the case of antiprotons? You expect an antiproton to scatter through the tissue just like a proton, because from the point of view of a proton and antiproton, we don't really exist. We're just empty. I mean, most of the volume of the body is just electrons. Antiprotons don't interact with electrons. Well, they scatter off electrons, but they don't annihilate. And only a few grains of nuclei are occasionally present. So an antiproton can enter tissue just like a proton and will scatter off the electrons just like a proton. It will slow down just like a proton. So up to here, one doesn't expect any difference between protons and antiprotons. But when the antiproton has stopped, it's captured by an atom. It annihilates with a nucleus and breaks up this nucleus, produces high-energy pions that come flying out, and nuclear fragments. These nuclear fragments don't travel very far. They just travel a few micron, just far enough to reach the neighboring cells. And so what you expect for antiprotons is that in addition to this energy deposit profile, there's a very strong peak exactly at the center where you want to irradiate the cancer. So antiprotons should be more efficient than protons. And in fact, by looking at the simulations and what we know about protons, we expect a factor of 3 increase over protons in efficiency targeting the cells that you want to target. Yeah?
Yeah, I have a question. All the energy released in that annihilation at the nucleus will also damage the cells that are healthy and are around the tumor.
Yes, but the range of these nuclear fragments is rather short. It's a few microns. So it will damage the neighboring cell and maybe the cell after that. But a cancer tumor is not a micron thick. It's usually a millimeter or a bit bigger. So I agree that the surface of the tumor will be slightly washed out. You're going to kill a few healthy cells around the tumor as well as the tumor itself. But if you want to reach the same damage to the tumor with protons, you have to increase the dose of protons by a factor of 3. And so you're going to damage all these healthy cells here in addition to that. So you're killing more healthy cells with protons than with antiprotons, because you can really localize the damage with antiprotons.
What I understand is why the antiproton is going to annihilate only at the level of the tumor, not before, because there are a lot of cells before.
Okay. Let me increase the picture a little bit. You can tune the energy of the antiproton so that it stops to a precision of about, well, half a millimeter. By giving an antiproton a very specific energy, you can determine its range or define its range to half a millimeter. So all the antiprotons will be spread out over half a millimeter. Now, in addition to that, by smearing out by the nuclear fragmentation, this is smeared out by an additional few microns, let's say 5 microns. So compared to the straggling in the range of the antiprotons, the further smearing is negligible. It doesn't add very much more. The real problem is how precisely you can stop the antiprotons and the protons. They have the same range in matter. So the best you can do, in any case, is going to be a spheroid or whatever, some volume, defined to half a millimeter size. You're going to kill everything within that half a millimeter envelope, whether it's healthy or unhealthy. And that's the same for protons or antiprotons. That doesn't change. The antiprotons just add in this 5 micrometer additional smearing, which is negligible on the scale of 500 microns. But in principle, you're right. If you could make a very sharp stopping profile, then the antiprotons would kill more healthy cells. But because of the statistical process of slowing down of antiprotons and protons, this is as good as you can do.
Can I say something?
Sure.
What I was thinking is maybe the best way to do it was to have a target in the tumor that will only alleviate with the beam that you are sending inside, and that way it will be precisely and you won't damage any of the cells. It's a way that you can put a target inside the tumor.
Yes, you can do that. It's been done with proton therapy or with other therapy, where you don't use the target to annihilate something, but you use a target that can be activated, becomes radioactive. And then you basically have a radioactive source inside the tumor. But it's very difficult to do. And you have to, if you can get to the tumor to place a target inside, you can also operate on it. Where you would use this kind of therapy is places where you cannot operate anymore. For example, cancers of the eye, where if you cut, then the eye is gone. Or cancers of the spinal cord, where if you make a slight mistake, you're going to damage the healthy nervous tissue and you might paralyze the patient. So it's a very specific application. And for the well-being, I have to say, it's completely speculative because we don't know yet. Well, we almost don't know. We've done the measurement last year, but we haven't published the results yet. That antiprotons are 3 times more efficient than protons at killing cells where you want them to be killed. But there's an additional advantage of antiprotons that you don't have with protons, and that's also another reason why you want to pursue this, and that is that the antiprotons, when they annihilate, not only produce nuclear fragments, but also high-energy pions. And these pions leave the body, and you can detect their trajectories and reconstruct very precisely the point where the antiprotons stop. So you can reconstruct antiproton by antiproton where the antiproton stopped. And you can make sure that every antiproton stops inside the tumor because you've measured the tumor beforehand and you know where it is. You cannot do that with protons because protons, once they're inside the body, they stop and they're gone. You don't see anything. So you're basically shooting blind when you do radiation therapy with protons. And because of that, the radiation therapy with protons typically is done in numerous steps. You irradiate, and then you measure and see whether you hit the healthy tissue or the unhealthy tissue. And if you hit the healthy tissue, well, you go back and you crank up the energy a little bit. You go back and forth and back and forth. It's a very time-consuming process. It's not quite as bad as I describe it, but basically you don't know where you're shooting, and if there are any differences between where you think you're stopping the protons and where they really stop, you're damaging healthy tissue. With antiprotons, you can guarantee that practically every antiproton stops inside the unhealthy tissue. And that's a very big advantage. Now, I have to be honest. Right now, we're only doing this test experiment with cells. So we have a body which is about the size of my finger. It's gelatin. And there are live hamster cells suspended in this gelatin. And then we irradiate. And then we count how many cells survived as a function of the depth. And we hope that we kill all the cells where we... well, in the region we call the tumor, and that we kill no cells outside the tumor. In reality, it's, of course, not going to be quite that good, but it's certainly, right now, from our measurements of last year, we already know that it's a factor of 3 better than with protons. So we damage a factor of 3 less healthy cells, or we kill cancer cells 3 times more efficiently, whichever way you want to put it. And this year, we're going to continue studying this, in particular also, in view of reconstructing where the antiprotons actually stopped, and trying to understand what kind of damage these nuclear fragments do. It's enough that they kill a cell once, and to kill a cell, you have to do a double DNA strand break. If you only do a single strand break, the cell can repair it. And so what we're trying to see this year is what kind of repair mechanisms the body can bring to work on the cells that are being irradiated with antiprotons. Okay. That's for the short term. For the long term, maybe some point 10 years down the road, we might be able to consider irradiating people and healing them, but not anytime soon. Okay, I've given you an overview of what physics is being done here, also what biology is being done here at CERN with antiprotons. And I don't know if you have questions about what I've said or in general before we go over to the experiments and I show you how these things really look like.
I didn't get the difference between the two experiments, Athena and Atra.
Well, it's a very small difference. The main difference is in the... It's a philosophical difference. It's a philosophical... Because neither of the two experiments knew how to make antihydrogen, we had very different ideas of how the experiments would be successful. What would be the successful road to make antihydrogen? Now, both of the experiments need antiprotons. Both of them need positrons. But that's where the similarities end. The Athena experiment thinks that, or thought at the time, that it was more important to have large numbers of positrons. And so they used a technique that made a much worse vacuum, because you have to do all these experiments in vacuum. And because the vacuum is much worse, they had to construct a detector that would allow them to distinguish between annihilations of antiprotons in the vacuum, on rest gas, and real antihydrogen annihilations on the outside of the walls. So their detector is very sophisticated and very fine, has very fine granularity, is very efficient, very much like an LHC detector. The other experiment thought that they had very much expertise in vacuum, so they worked with the best possible vacuum that limited the number of positrons that they could have, decreased it by a factor of 1,000. They have 1,000 less positrons than Athena. And they thought that every signal that they would see would be antihydrogen, so they built a very simple detector. Now, it turns out that even in their case, there is background, and they didn't consider that background. So they made the wrong choice, I think, simply by building the detector outside of their magnet rather than inside. It's easier to build it outside because there's lots of space. Inside, you have to work in the cold. It's a cryogenic environment. It's a very high magnetic field. It's very it's vacuum, of course. And you have to bring out all the signals. And so it's a very, very difficult detector to build. And I think that's why they decided not to do it. They should have. They would see much better what's going on inside. But it's small philosophical difference, and then that has big repercussions down the road. And they solved the problem of detecting antihydrogen very much more elegantly than Athena did, in a very different way. But if you want, I'll explain it, but it's rather involved. Mick.
How does the transition between what you're doing in the research lab at CERN, where you're actually trying to study some real physical phenomena, and that this, on the side you've now decided you're going to do these studies for medical applications, mm-hmm. How do you make the transition from what you're doing, how does it work into industry, how do you convince somebody to come along and say, hey, this is a neat thing and we should try and build something?
Well, I was fortunate not to be involved in that convincing process. The biological experiment is funded by an American company. These are angel investors. They are aware that the likelihood of success is very low, and that the possible return on investment could be rather high, because if the method works, then it's a very very efficient method. And so you have to have basically speculators at that point who are interested in investing. How the director of that, how principal investigator of that experiment got these investors to be interested, I don't know. It's been in the air for a long time, and that part happened in America. Now, the part where the real transfer of technology to industry is happening here at CERN and in Geneva. We're collaborating with the University of Geneva, the hospital, the HUG, Hôpital Universitaire de Genève, who are involved in doing all the biology of these experiments. And there the work is, well, they're scientists, you can talk with them. Their way of thinking is somewhat different from a physicist's way of thinking. But there's enough common ground that we can communicate, and by talking with them, we're transferring a lot of the basic knowledge.
Now, you say it might take 10, 15 years to build a device which can actually help you.
Yes.
Is that simply a matter of money? If you had a factor of 10 more money,
no.
Could it go faster?
It's a question of time, mostly. We're still at the level where we're studying the effects of antiprotons on single cells or clusters of cells. The next step would be, once we understand that, would be to irradiate a full organ, let's say a liver, a rat's liver, and to study the physiological changes. Then, once you've done that, you have to irradiate a series of rats to make sure that there are no side effects. Now, we know that there are no side effects. Physicists, they understand the physics, but the biologists want to make sure that there are no dangerous side effects. So you just have to go through a certain number of animal tests until you can start thinking about doing a first human test. And then you do the same with humans. You do one, then 10, then maybe 100. You evaluate the side effects. And the side effects can take a long time to develop. And typically, if you're working with radiation, you would not expect radiation side effects to appear immediately. They might cause a secondary cancer 5 years down the road or 10 years down the road. So you have to follow the development of the patients that you've treated. And so until you actually get to the point where you can do large-scale treatment, it's simply a question of time. It's not money. Money is not the limit at this point. It will be when we've done the basic science and when you start thinking about irradiating people. Because then some investor has to come up with something like the AD and the PS to produce antiprotons for a clinical environment. The conditions under which the antiprotons are produced here are not optimal. You'd like to be able to irradiate continuously. At the AD, you just throw 10 to the 7 antiprotons in one burst at the patient or at the cells, and then you do nothing for 2 minutes. And so it takes much too long in real time to irradiate the cells. We have to keep them cold, and there are many constraints that are too tough for patients. You'd have to keep the patient immobilized for half a day, basically. I don't know many patients who would be willing to do that. As it is now, if you increase the rate of production by a factor of 10 or 100, then you could do the irradiation in 10 minutes, and it would only be once, which is also not bad.
Is there anywhere else you can do this?
No, this is it, at CERN. The only place in the world where antiprotons are produced that are sufficiently slow that we can do these experiments. There's a place in construction in Germany at GSI where from 2012 or something like that onwards there will also be antiprotons available at the same energies. But for the while being, this is the only game in town.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Can you explain a little more about the second language acquisition that has been detected with the test?
Okay. I don't know much more than I told you, but basically you try to study in children when they speak the first language and the second language, which part of the brain is active. And you can see that the parts of the brain that are active with PET. That's how you recognize where the language centers are of the brain. And if you do that same scan of an adult speaking the first language, you see that it's the same part of the brain as for a child. Language center is the same. But if the adult speaks the second language that he learned as an adult, then it's a different part of the brain than for the first language. Whereas for a child, it's the same part of the brain. That's as far as it goes, what I know about this. I could give you links to the corresponding information. You can also do PET positron emission tomography in real time as a movie. So you can actually see changes in the brain in real time. My favorite example, there was once a conference in Geneva of a guy who works with positron emission tomography, and he showed a movie to some unwitting suspects, measured their brain activity, and the movie was a James Bond movie. And it was just the beginning of the movie, so the suspects were men in this particular case. And so at the beginning of the movie, there's no activity in the brain at all. Not really surprising. And then a woman walks on the screen, and all of a sudden the brain starts lighting up left, right, and center.
This made me think of a comment, actually. I remember when I first came to CERN in 1975, I was working up in the West area. And I remember listening to some guys who were very similar to Michael, who were working on developing positron emission tomography and trying very hard to get CERN to fund their experiments that they were doing then, and that's like 29 years ago.
in the meantime, it's a multi-billion dollar industry.
But it's taken off from something like Michael is talking about today has become what it is when you never get paid. It takes that, that time to do it. I'm not sure why it takes that, even though
A lot of it is just hard work solving technical problems. Some of it is just convincing your colleagues that this is important stuff. That's what takes most time often, that you can try to get beam time. To convince CERN that we could do this experiment with live cells was not trivial. There were many administrative obstacles. Because it's not physics, it doesn't belong to CERN in many people's minds. And to convince people that this is the only place in the world that you can do it and that it's worthwhile doing. And then there's a competing technology that I didn't mention, but that is also, this has to do with the politics then. In Germany, people are working on replacing protons with carbon ions. And carbon ions also have a very sharp peak, deposit their energy very nicely inside the tumor. And for them, any work that challenges their position as being the best possible technology for treating cancer is worrying. They consider this as an affront, even if it turns out that antiprotons are not as efficient. But still, there has been an amount of political work to do, some obstacles to overcome, to be able to do these experiments. And that takes time. People are mostly the problem.
Okay. Thank you very much, Michael.